Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is April 13th, 2017. We have big work sessions ahead of us. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3405, Representative Hayden's bill. Cassie, please give us a summary.
House Bill 3405 requires Department of Human Services to submit a waiver request of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, requirements to exclude advance payment of Oregon's dependent care tax credit when determining income eligibility for SNAP. The bill requires DHS to report annually regarding the status of the request until a decision from the U.S. Department of Agriculture is received. The bill is effective the 91st day following sine die and is repealed January 1st, 2023. We have the fiscal. The fiscal is minimal, and there is no revenue impact.
Okay. So, again, in my layperson term, I'm just going to summarize from my perspective what this is. Representative Hayden, this is the third session that he has been working on this issue, and the idea was something that started in the Human Services Committee a couple of years ago when we were looking at child care tax benefits, tax credits. And the idea is rather than have all the tax credits given in April of, say, 2017 that were accrued in 2016, why not be able to give people a portion of the benefits that they are going to get, the portion of the tax credits that they're going to get every month? Because the idea is to really help people pay their child care at the time. The question has arisen that if you get monthly payments for your tax credits as opposed to in one lump sum, would that all of a sudden be counted as income against possible eligibility for TANF and other things? That is not his intention. He does not want to mess with the income eligibility. He just wants to be able to get tax credits out to people monthly so that they can keep up with their child care bills, which we know are really expensive. So this is an effort that I have supported. I think it's a great intent, and I do want the question clarified. It's a very simple bill, just asking for a waiver to give us that assurance. Okay, so can I have a motion?
Absolutely. Chair Kenny Guyer, I move House Bill 3405 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue be rescinded.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 3405 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the committee, House Committee on Revenue be rescinded. Any discussion on that motion?
Yes.
Chair Kenny Guyer, I appreciate Rep. Hayden's work on this and the concepts behind this. I'm gonna be a no. I have two kind of underlying reasons why. One is you and I have had this conversation, and if you were around in 2015, I really struggle with the concept of refundable credits, and that's a difference in perspective on how tax credits and so forth are supposed to be used. But more so, I've done some looking into the federal guidelines on this, and I think it's more than a Hail Mary to actually get the feds to agree to a waiver on this, and so I feel like it's putting more work on the plate of, you know, DHS for something that is highly unlikely to actually come to fruition. And I don't want to pile more on given some of the things they have going on right now. But I do appreciate Rep. Hayden's work and his tenacity, and I like the concept behind it, but I'm going to be a no at this point.
Okay. And just to clarify for anyone else who may be compelled by that, the waiver doesn't take a lot of work to request a waiver. And the response from the feds when we say, is it clear that these a monthly tax credit could count against eligibility, we've gotten mixed answers, and that's why we want the assurance. So I don't consider it a far cry, like this is going to be really hard to get. I'm hoping that it'll be relatively easy, but we do need that answer, definitive answer, before we go about trying to design a program where you put the tax credits back on the EBT or whatever other way we might come up with it. We need the clarity about it.
Madam Chair. Okay. I hope that you're right, and if you end up being right, I will come and write you a card or bring you flowers or something and saying, well, say well done.
Chocolate.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. All right. Any other discussion?
Right. I just hope that we'll all get flowers.
Or chocolate.
Yeah, oh, chocolate.
Maybe it'll be
chocolate for all.
We need caffeine on this committee. Okay, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative
Meek? Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Russo?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny
Geyer? Aye. Okay, motion passes, and I will assign Rep. Hayden to be the carrier. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3405. Open a work session on House Bill 2534. The Reardons.
House Bill 2534 establishes the Community Leverage Fund as of January 1st, 2018, and directs the Oregon Business Development Department to make grants and loans to fund proposals that address outcomes in health, early learning, workforce, and economic development and education. The bill allows counties, cities, school districts, post-secondary institutions, early learning hubs, regional achievement collaboratives, workforce investment boards, or regional solutions advisory committees to apply for grants and loans, and specifies that the grants and loans be distributed in substantially equal amounts among economic development regions in the state. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a dash two. The dash two replaces the bill and establishes the Oregon Opportunity Commission as of January 1st, 2018, and specifies the purpose of the commission to award funds, develop assessment tools, review laws and rules, and identify incentives to address concentrated poverty. The amendment specifies commission membership to consist of 19 members, including nonprofit organizations supporting racial minorities and Native American communities. The amendment allows the commission to administer the oath and take depositions and issue subpoenas, and establishes the Oregon Opportunity Fund and continually appropriates money to the commission. The amendment specifies an amount appropriated from the general funds is in addition to and not in lieu of any other appropriation, and declares an emergency effective on passage. We do have a fiscal, and the fiscal requires further analysis, and the revenue is minimal, and there is a sub-referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Any questions on this? My layperson language, this is an attempt to look at poverty, I think particularly in rural areas, and to bring different departments, Oregon Business Council, together. Their hope is that in this time of really constrained resources, that this would be a leveraging opportunity. People would, you know, need it more than ever. We held it over because we were trying to get a better fiscal. I wanted a sense of what the fiscal would be, because eventually we're going to try to, as soon as we get past April 18th, try to do some prioritization of the things that we've passed, and I really wanted a fiscal on everything coming out of here. So we held it over for that purpose, and they're swamped. They still haven't been able to do it. And when they know it's going on to another committee, they make it second priority. And so we still have an unclear fiscal on this, but I think the concept is really good and received no opposition, a lot of support. So any other discussion on the bill? Okay, do I have a motion?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 24, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 24, 2017. Any more discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2534 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2534 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Morrison?
Yes.
Representative Meade?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Close the work session on House Bill 2534. Open a work session on House Bill 3357, document recording fee.
House Bill 3357 increases the fee amount charged and collected by county clerks to $40 for certain real property documents, and requires 25% of the money to be deposited into the general housing account, homeownership assistance, and emergency housing account programs at Oregon Housing and Community Services, and be allocated to provide affordable housing and assist veterans. The bill defines affordable housing as housing purchased or rented affordable to individuals of low income or very low income. We do have a dash one amendment. The dash one amendment redefines affordable housing and clarifies provisions of the measure to provide affordable housing through the specified accounts, and maintains 25% of the funds dedicated to assisting veterans' housing needs. The fiscal requires further analysis, and there is no revenue impact, and we have a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means.
But I think we're going to send it to revenue.
Can we do that? Okay, can I have a motion? Then I'll discuss.
Chair Kenny Guyer, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 7, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 7, 2017. Any discussion? I just want to say with the Dash 1, basically when you heard the original that said 25% are going into affordable housing, that was very confusing, and there was some language in there that needed to be cleaned up. The 25% of this fund refers to when we increased from the document recording fee from $15, we increased it by $5. That meant there was a 25% increase that would go just for veterans. So in all of the categories that the document recording fee goes, the formula is 10% for emergency housing assistance, 14% for home ownership, looking to make sure I get this right, 76% for multifamily housing, meaning new construction or preservation. Hope I have those numbers right. That of that, 25% of that would go to veterans. The original way the bill was written was a little confusing with this 25% affordable housing, because it's all for affordable housing. 25% goes to the veterans. So the Dash 1 amendment simply clarifies some of that language where the drafting had gotten it a little confused with the veterans. There has not been a decision. There's been a kind of big up in the air whether the county clerks would have the 5% that they normally get in document recording fees. There's no decision on that. We're recommending that this gets passed on without inserting that into the bill. So any other discussion pieces on this?
Not on the Dash 1, but on the bill.
Okay, so let's adopt the amendment. Any objection to adopting the amendment, which clarifies the language? Okay. Amendments are adopted. Let's get a motion on the bill itself.
Chair Kenny Guyer, I move House Bill 3357 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, are we rescinding?
Mm-hmm.
Be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 3357 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue. Okay, discussion.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. I just wanted to speak in support of this, and as everybody knows, yesterday was Realtor Day at the Capitol, and I had probably a combination of 15 conversations with different realtors, and many of these folks, I was able to shop this to them and let them know some of the work I was doing and working on, listening to, and the majority of them thought it was a great idea, and I didn't get any pushback, and some of the folks that are leaders in this industry actually thought that they were excited to see that, they wanted to know the numbers, and I told them, and nobody had great concern about that. And so I support this, and I'm hoping that we can get this through and get some more funds to affordable housing.
Thank you. And I'll just add that I am really passionate about this. There are very few dedicated sources of funding that we have for affordable housing. And we talk a lot about home ownership, preservation, construction of multifamily housing, and the Emergency Housing Fund. We've heard about it from all parts of the state, where renters are displaced and they need help with either relocation or keeping up with increases. Counties can use that money. Housing authorities can use that money to help people keep up with the increases so that they don't get displaced and end up on the streets. So there's been a lot of discussion about whether we increase this or whether we depend on the general fund. And the general fund, as you know, that is not a reliable source at all when we're looking at pretty dramatic cuts in the general fund everywhere else. So the only two dedicated sources right now that we have ongoing is the document recording fee and then the affordable housing tax credit, which we will be hearing later today. These are the only two. So for all the talk that we do about supply and how important it is, and I can see why realtors would be supportive, because if you're creating more supply, then there's more transactions to be had. So for all the talk that we do about that, this is one of the few places that we can really get some revenue.
So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Meek, if you don't mind my asking, just to clarify, was that just a broad general consensus or perspective, or was that a formal statement of the association? Because I know in the past you've represented them in that level.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, sir, for clarification. No, that's not a statement from the association at all. Okay. That's a statement from, you know, basically kind of folks in the industry that, you know, basically have been involved in leadership. But and a lot of the folks that care about, you know, government affairs and public policy show up at these meetings, you know, for Capitol, you know, Realtor Day at the Capitol. And but in no way means or in no ways or means did that represent the association's position on it. I have no idea what they're going to say. But from folks that are in the industry, selling homes, working with people and the clients in the field, they thought that they didn't think it was going to be over onerous, and that they thought it was great to see that opportunity.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no, and a couple different reasons. One is that I'm concerned with doubling the fees on homeowners, and I did have some discussion yesterday with some realtors as well. They were struggling with it. There's several folks that are down in the Mid Valley and everything. So I greatly appreciate your work. I really do. I mean, and I understand that this is one of two avenues on where we're wanting to try to move forward with housing. But I'll be a no.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to echo what Representative Olson said, I had a great chance yesterday to meet with a bunch of realtors. I think we had more people in our caucus room than we normally have. And a chance all from Yamhill County. And I think to best represent their interests and concerns, I will also be a no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Borsig?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Noble?
No.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
No, thank you.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion passes. This bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Revenue. Close the work session on House Bill 3357. Open a work session on House Bill 3372. Cassie, could you please remind us of this bill?
House Bill 3372 requires a coordinated care organization to provide initial health screening for each foster child under 19 years of age no later than 60 days after the child enrolls in a CCO or the child enters the foster care system, whichever date is earlier. The bill requires a CCO to locate the child and arrange the initial health screening if the child has not received the screening within 60 days, and requires CCOs to report to Oregon Health Authority on noncompliance. The bill requires OHA to analyze the report and reduce barriers to compliance, and directs OHA to report on rates of compliance by September 15, 2018. We do have a dash one amendment. The dash one amendment clarifies the provision of initial health screening to a child no later than 60 days after the child enrolls in a CCO. We have the fiscal and the revenue, and both have no impact.
Okay. We have a motion.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 11, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 11, 2017. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I am a little surprised, not that I would expect it to be much, but that OHA wouldn't have put some sort of fiscal if they're supposed to track and report on it. But apparently they will do it with existing resources. Was there any conversation on that?
There is actually already tracking that happens, but it's only tracking on kind of a metric, and so it's not, they're not meeting the metric. That's why the bill is important. So they're already doing it.
Got it. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any objection to the amendment? All right. The amendments are adopted. Motion on the bill.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 3372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 3372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Phil Batchew.
Yes.
Representative B.
Aye.
Representative
Meerman. Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative
Pusa. Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Chair
Kindergarten. Aye. Motion passes. Representative Sanchez, will you carry this on the floor?
Absolutely.
All right. Close the work session on House Bill 3372. And we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2903. Representative Olson's bill. Kathy, can you please read the summary?
Okay.
House Bill 2903 modifies the definition of abuse for child care agencies and removes certain definitions and requires DHS to respond to allegations, complaints, or formal reports and clarifies procedures for DHS when an incident of suspected abuse is life-threatening or affects the physical safety of a child. The bill allows the director of DHS to issue a letter of concern or reprimand for substantiated reports of abuse that was not life-threatening and does not affect the physical safety of the child and clarifies criteria for licensing, certifying, or authorizing a child care agency to provide services. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a dash 3 amendment. The dash 3 amendment replaces the bill and allows DHS to immediately place conditions on the license, certificate, or authorization of a child caring agency for noncompliance with specified requirements. The amendment allows the director of DHS to rescind suspension or revocation of a license, certificate, or authorization of a child care agency if an agreement is made with the director of Oregon Youth Authority and if the child care agency provides medical or psychiatric services with the director of Oregon Health Authority. The amendment requires director of DHS to submit written notice to the governor of intent to rescind suspension or revocation and requires the child care agency to renew license, certificate, or authorization on an annual basis for 3 years following the notice of intent to suspend or revoke. The amendment requires DHS to submit a report to the legislative committees regarding deemed status determination of a child care agency by September 15th, 2018, and repeals the report submission on January 2nd, 2019. The amendment declares an emergency effective on passage. We do have the fiscal. The fiscal is minimal, and there is no revenue impact.
Okay, motion.
Chair Kinnegar, I move to adopt the dash 3 amendments dated April 4th, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments dated April 4th, 2017. Any discussion? Representative Ellison, would you like to say any words?
It's about time.
Yeah. Yes, Representative.
Madam Chair, apparently I have a lot to say today. I just want to comment on the dash 3s. The dash 3s are a great example of bipartisan negotiations and where there was a significant problem, significant differences in how to address the problem. At times, things felt hostile between different groups, but when all is said and done, people got together across the aisle, throughout the building, advocates on different sides, to come up with the dash threes that, you know, not everybody loved, but everybody can live with and are going to help. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate the hard work and the amount of conversations and the effort that people put into the dash threes and making them work. You know, Representative Olson and Senator Gelson significantly coming together to figure out something that works. So thank you, Rep. Olson, and for everybody who was part of that.
Okay, now I guess I all right. Yeah, chime in. You know, the reason that we moved forward with what originally the 2903 was to protect the providers that were out there. Madam Chair, you get that. And I shared with all of you here, too, about this whole thing. We were kind of a little bit of on a collision course with what was happening with the Senate Bill 246 on this regarding the off-ramp of what was happening as a result of Senate Bill 1515 from the short session. And not going into detail, there was something that we had to do to try to make this work better for providers, not closing down their centers and all of a sudden closing down beds in the meantime. We needed to also give some support to Department of Human Services as well. I think that was critical. Where we're at with the dash threes is a big move. So I'm grateful for that.
So, yes, I'll echo all that. I think this is an important step forward. I know that protecting kids is at the center of everything. We don't want to lose beds. We want to hold both the agency as well as the providers accountable, and we want to do it in a way that's clear, that has off-ramps when there have been problems, and that has accountability, but also tries to be clear, tries to provide the resources. I think giving financial resources to these agencies is a huge piece that we need to continue to work on. I know that there were some things in definition of child abuse in Dash 1 that some would have liked. There are some steps that some would have liked to have carried forward. So these are steps forward. Some would have liked to have gone farther. I think there's a commitment to continue talking about it in the interim with the definition of child abuse and other issues that were on the table. So I do think it's a great move forward. Thank you very much for working bicamerally and bipartisan on this bill. Okay. Any other discussion on the bill? On the amendment? We're still on the amendment. Okay, so any objection to the amendments? Dash 3. Seeing none, they are adopted.
Chair Kenny Guyer, I move House Bill 2903 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2903 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Representative
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair
Kamiya? Aye. Motion passes.
Choose me.
You're chosen. You're chosen one. Representative Olson will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2903, opening a work session on House Bill 2007. Yes. Representative, we're going to skip one because the speaker is here. So, Speaker Kotek. And would you like to have Chandler and Meredith?
John, do you want to join?
I'm joined. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Yep. So this bill is going to be carried over to April 18th, 8 a.m., because we are waiting on the amendments. But in order to save time, given that that will be a very full day, we'll have an explanation of the amendments. I think they've not yet hit OLIS. Is that right? You will walk us through what they will be. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Good to see you again. We are talking about House Bill 2007 today. There is testimony online for me and also, believe, a Dash 1, but there will be a Dash 2. But I'm going to walk you through the Dash 1. So, as I've said many times during the session, we need a multi-pronged approach to dealing with the housing crisis here in the state, protecting our tenants, preserving our existing affordable housing, and actually building more. There's been a lot of conversation in this committee. You've done great work. This is a bill about supply. This is a bill about making it quicker and faster and more efficient to build, because we are hundreds of thousands of units short, not only in affordable housing, but workforce housing in this state. So what you have before you today is 2007. There, like I said, there will be a Dash 2. But let me walk you through what the bill does. And then the folks next to me who have been working on the bill with me will give you more details as well. So the bill will do 8 things. First thing it'll do, it will require cities and counties to fast-track affordable housing projects in their permitting processes. I've heard a lot from developers about the length of time in permitting. Just so you know, affordable housing in this bill is defined as 50% of units affordable at 60% of median family income with an affordability covenant of at least 60 years. We are trying to make sure we can build and then have these units stay affordable as much as possible. State law currently requires local jurisdictions to review and make a determination on an application for construction within 120 days of receipt of the application. This bill would change that 120-day requirement to 100 days for affordable housing projects, as I said, as we define it. Number 2, it directs the Department of Land Conservation and Development to study the average timeline between submission of a complete application and certificate of occupancy and identify barriers to shortening that timeline, focusing on cities by a certain date to have that review done so we can explore other ways to reduce barriers to getting things in the pipeline. Number 3, the bill requires cities and counties to approve applications that meet clear and objective standards as outlined in local zoning or planning codes within urban growth boundaries. You will hear from cities that they have concerns about the clear and objective standards. But I've also heard from cities that they have no issue with this requirement. Clear and objective standards is part of our land use system. It's part of Goal 10. It is possible to have a permitting process that allows for local control regarding design and clear and objective standards related to those design preferences. So we need to get serious about the clear and objective standards, and I think we can do that within also taking into consideration design. Number four, the bill would update the definition of needed housing. So in Goal 10, it talks about needed housing. This would update that to include housing that is affordable to low and moderate income people. This is important because cities need a better handle on their inventory of affordable housing compared to the need, and identifying affordable housing as needed in state statute moves us forward. So we can talk about housing all day long, but if it's all high-end and unaffordable, we haven't addressed the need for the range of units we need. Number five, this bill requires local jurisdictions to let developers build housing with density that is permitted in the local zoning code unless doing so poses a risk to health, safety, or habitability. I am sure there is nothing more frustrating for a developer to be approved for density and then be told for other discretionary reasons that they cannot build to that density. And if we're going to build more units, we have to have more density as allowed to by the zoning codes. This would say unless there's a safety or health issue, you need to follow your density goals. Number six, it clarifies that historic designation process may not reduce, quote, needed housing, which now includes affordable housing. So in Portland in particular, we have a lot of historic designations, and we want to make sure that just because you have one doesn't mean you don't also have to meet your needed housing goals. And that includes affordable housing under this bill. Number seven, it prohibits outright bans on the development of accessory dwelling units and duplexes on land zoned for single-family housing. Again, single-family housing is the zone. We need to build more density. We need more options, and ADUs and duplexes should be part of that. And if the state has to tell folks to do it, that's what this bill will do. Number eight, lastly, this allows religious organizations with land located within urban growth boundaries to build affordable housing within the conditions of local zoning and planning requirements. Again, we've had a conversation in another bill about this. We have religious organizations that have land they want to build, and they're in places that make sense from a residential perspective. They're just having to go through conditional permitting all the time, and it really slows things down. This would make it a lot quicker for those organizations to build. So like I said, there's a dash one online. There will be a dash two that will reflect what I just went through. And I just want you to know this has taken a while to get here, not because it's complicated, but I wanted to make sure we had as many voices at the table as possible. So we've had developers and land use activists and housing experts and realtors and property owners saying, why can't you build more quicker? Mm-hmm. So this is what you have. 2007 is you're going to hear from the cities. It is a real clear change of direction for the state to say to cities, you need to do some of this stuff. And I just hope you'll keep an open mind and help us make the best bill possible. We do need to address the supply issue in our state. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members. Meredith Shield, representing Thousand Friends of Oregon. I want to thank Speaker Kotek and Taylor Smiley Wolf for their hard work on this important and innovative piece of legislation. At Thousand Friends, we are very excited about 2007. This bill aims to make affordable, accessible, age-friendly housing available to more people of all ages, ability, income, and backgrounds in thriving neighborhoods. We've been working with the Home Builders Association, and my friend over here, John Chandler, is going to walk us through the Dash 1 Amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler here on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I cannot tell you how excited I am to have this bill moving. And I really appreciate the hard work that Speaker Kotek and her staff, Ms. Taylor Smiley-Wolf, have put into this. I've been working on these issues for a long time, and if you'll indulge me just for a moment, a bit of context for this bill. The Oregon land use system, when it was adopted back in the 70s, had several premises, one of which was that we were going to protect farm and forest land, and the best way to do that was to make sure that we had then designated areas inside of urban growth boundaries. Every city in the state was told to go adopt urban growth boundaries, comprehensive plans, zoning maps, and so on. And the notion was that it was going to be difficult to build outside and easy to build inside. That didn't quite play out. But back in the 90s, I used to do a fair amount of speaking around the country on Oregon's land use system, because a lot of states were looking and jurisdictions were looking at something similar. And I was able then to say legitimately, it isn't a bad deal. You know what the zoning is. You know what your rights are as a developer. You understand if you're a citizen what's going to happen in your neighborhood. If you're a farmer, you know that you have the ability to continue your operations. The deal was working. It has, over the last 20, 30 years, worked less and less and less and less, and now to the point where it is difficult, if not impossible, to build outside the boundary, and difficult, if not impossible, to build inside the boundary in a timely fashion, only slightly overstating. So the context for this is, this bill is trying to go back to the original concept that Governor McCaul had with Senate Bill 100, frankly, that we are going to now develop our cities. And the downside of that for a neighborhood, of course, is if you're going to keep an urban growth boundary tight and you have a constant supply demand for growth and for housing, you're going to densify neighborhoods. That's going to irritate the folks living there. But it does get binary very quickly. If you don't want to irritate the folks living there, then you're going to have to move the boundary. And this bill has, I'm not trying to revisit that entire conversation, but to simply say, in the context of our land use planning system, a bill like this, the focus this bill is bringing to this, is really essential for the underlying system to work. And not to get ahead of the amendments, but the issue of current objective standards, for example, just so you know, has been in the Oregon state law since the early 80s. This is not a new requirement at all. What's new is, we're kind of serious about it this time. And I think that's critical, because that, again, if a system is going to work the way it was designed, development has to be allowed to occur in a timely, expeditious fashion. That's part of our affordability issue, it's part of our supply issue, and frankly, it's just part of the deal that was struck that we believe ought to be continued. So, to the amendments as they come forward, and the speaker did an excellent job of summarizing these, but with regard to fast-tracking development, the issue right now under current law, 120 days, which gets honored in the breach, but at least it's assigned to cities and counties, you're supposed to do this quickly. And basically, what we've told the cities and counties is, you can have all the process you want. You can have as many hearings, you can have as many work groups, you can have as many task forces, whatever it is, but you've got 120 days. And so with this bill now, we're saying for affordable projects, it's 100 days. And again, the 20 days doesn't sound like much, but two things I believe are going to happen. One is, we're doubling down on the commitment that we're trying to make these processes go more quickly by sending that 20-day reduction signal. And secondly, to understanding, for particularly for affordable projects, not the stuff that my clientele does, but the subsidized, the government-assisted, the not-for-profits, a delay is deadly. A delay is deadly because it takes you out of your funding window. It stalls you through your grant. Your options expire. And in the private sector, for-profit developer, there's usually, we have more ability to get around those things. If you're stacking up a six-foot stack of grant applications and funding requests and conditional loan guarantees and what have you, 20 days is a lifetime. So I think this is going to really help the affordable housing, the not-for-profit sector in particular, get the needed projects built. The other thing that happens in these first sections on fast-tracking is, we're telling DLCD, we're giving them some homework, Department of Land Conservation and Development, go figure out why development is taking as long as it does. Go find out what the facts are, not by anecdote or people like me coming and saying they're killing us, or the city's coming in and saying, no, we're not, but actually get some facts, figure out how long is it taking to get projects built, what are the impediments, what's the processing, is it developers turning in lousy applications? Maybe. Is it cities with too much process? Maybe, but let's go find out. And I'll put in a plug for House Bill 3373. Those of you who are on Ways and Means, we hope you'll look nicely on that one when you get a chance, because that's going to put some money behind this effort, which is going to be critical. The next piece here on the clear and objective standards, as I mentioned, that's been in the law for a long, long time. But the notion there is very simple. We're not trying to be mean to cities and counties. We're simply saying there has to be at least one path that is clear and objective. If you're a property owner developer, if you do the following things written down in that clear and objective path in the following sequence, you're good to go. That's all it says. They can have 577 different discretionary paths if they want, but they've got to have one clear and objective path as a default. That's the way the system is supposed to work. We believe this will really help close some loopholes by not only reminding cities they have to do this, but also closing down the loopholes. And I'll get into the land use weeds here for a little bit. We've had some cities getting very creative and saying they have surplus land, surplus lands being things that aren't on their buildable lands inventory, which is required by state land use law, or are not needed housing, which is also defined by land use law. There's no such thing as surplus land. What this is trying to say is, no, you got to have a clear and objective path for your housing zone, land zone for housing, full stop. Whether it's mixed-use housing, single-family housing, multifamily housing, doesn't matter. You got to have at least one clear and objective path go do that. And I think we're going to be changing the billable lands inventory language in the statute, and this is another bit down memory lane. In 2001, we fiddled with that particular statute. We added language to it that, honestly, none of us that were involved in that process remember why we added the language, but it created a loophole by tying things back to the billable lands inventory. One of my colleagues, land use lawyer, actually did the legislative research and went back through the committee hearings in 2011. I was there. I'd have no recollection myself. Mm-hmm. We're taking out the language we put in then because it didn't do anything, and it created this opportunity for mischief on the local level. We're also broadening, as the speaker mentioned, needed housing to include basically workforce housing, middle income, moderate income, or low income, moderate income, as well as we're adding mixed use housing to this. Because when we did this initially, mixed use was something planners talked about. It wasn't actually being built. Now it's being built all over the place, but we don't really have a good way to peg to hang that concept on in our land use law. So that's going to be part of the needed housing discussion this time. By not allowing lower density during the process without a good reason, that's going to help correct the underbuild problem where you have property that's zoned for 10 units the acre and a developer applies for that but only gets approved at 8 or 6 or 5. That contributes to the housing supply disconnect, obviously, and also just is not the way the system is supposed to work. If it's zoned for a use, it ought to be available for that use, and if it's not available for that use, then the zoning is wrong, it ought to be changed. Getting rid of the use of or prohibiting the use of historic designations as a dodge around land use laws. We're going to try to tighten that up. And by the way, just for the record, this has nothing to do with actual historic designations. Nobody at this panel is against historic designations. What we're trying to say is you can't use a historic designation as a smokescreen for encasing your neighborhood in amber so that no redevelopment occurs, no new people can move there. That's kind of cheating, frankly, and we're going to try to make sure that doesn't happen. With regard to the missing middle part of the discussion, which is hugely important, by simply telling cities you have to allow accessory dwelling units and duplexes in single-family zones, full stop, that's going to take a lot of the heat off the local level, frankly. That's a very politically contentious issue. This allows a little bit of cover for local elected officials. And frankly, in most neighborhoods, and probably some of you live in neighborhoods like this where there are duplexes and triplexes and quadplexes and what have you, mm-hmm. and if everybody paid no attention, you wouldn't notice it. Right. They're just houses. Yeah. Same thing here. We're now going to make that very possible to do. And finally, with regard to the religious property being used for affordable housing, that just makes all the sense in the world to me. There may be some flaws in it that I haven't spotted yet, but those tend to be, as the speaker mentioned, in neighborhoods, serving that neighborhood, having relationships and ties back to their communities in which they're functioning. This seems like this would be very beneficial, not just for the housing side, but for those institutions that are such a critical part of neighborhood fabric. Thank you for indulging me in that testimony. And again, this is an exciting bill. I'm very pleased with it. Thank you for encouraging me.
May I just add quickly, Madam Chair, I forgot something. Thank you, John, for the testimony. You'll see in the dash one that there's a whole large number of sections around high opportunity neighborhoods and model designs. We had to scrap that part. It's coming out. It just got too complicated. The idea there was the state should develop some template designs that we can then, in certain neighborhoods, just really fast-track them, And we just got too complicated, so we pulled the whole idea. We might come back in that in the short session. So if you see that there, that's coming out in the dash two.
The dash two will be a gut and stuff then.
Yes, a dash two replaces the whole bill.
Okay.
I just think it's interesting, Madam Chair, that the speaker would be sitting between the two of them, you know, kind of as a referee. Wisdom.
You've played that role before.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kenninger. Just want to say, you know, thank you guys for your efforts on this. The dash twos, the concepts there, love what you guys are doing with this. You know, so thank you, Speaker Kotek, for all your effort, and thank you, John, for coming and spending time with me to talk through these, because I think when it comes to dealing with supply, this is a great start, I think. So.
Yes, Representative.
Good, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll just toss this out to anybody, but on the fast track part of it, is there a chance that there's a developer that doesn't have an affordable component to their plan, and that developer never, ever gets their project approved? Is that possible, or
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, I meant to mention that as a very important point. We were making it clear in the language that we're fast tracking these. We are not slowing down those. So the cities are still on the hook for the 120-day processing for the regular market rate, other sorts of non-affordable housing. They simply have to move the other ones more quickly.
Good. Thank you
for pointing that out. I neglected to mention that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, John, thank you. Great work. I'm glad you brought in to the for the multifamily, well, the duplex, triplex, into a residential area, because they are very similar. But I have had worked with many developers or small builders that would love to. The density is there, and they want the density, but because they go to the county or the city, and they're just not willing to allow that, that there's lost opportunity there. And so this will alleviate the political issues and make it an issue that really we have to, if it's zoned that, we're trying to really bring on more housing, that it's a great opportunity, and there will be a lot of folks interested in taking advantage of that. So thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Colin. A lot of support from this committee here.
And it will go to Ways and Means if it comes out of here, by the way, because it'll have a fiscal, I would assume, for DLCD.
We will look forward to voting on it on Tuesday. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2007. Representative Speaker Kotek, you may want to stay. We're going to open House Bill work session on House Bill 2008 and invite Representative Fahey up. Cassie, can you remind us about the bill? We are not voting on this bill. We do not have the fiscals back, but we will be clear about what the different options on the table are, and we will be voting. I'm going to, for the record, carry this over to Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m., waiting on the paperwork. Oh, Cassie, please read the summary.
House Bill 2008 requires a landlord of a manufactured dwelling park, when closing the park to convert to other use, to pay the greater of either necessary relocation costs or the applicable park closure penalty as determined by the Manufactured Communities Resource Center, or MCRC. The bill allows local governments to enact and enforce policies requiring landlords to pay penalties or relocation costs in addition to these requirements, and specifies the time in which a landlord is required to pay the tenant for a penalty or necessary relocation costs. The bill requires the owner of a park to give notice to MCRC of interest in selling the park prior to marketing the park for sale, and requires the owner to provide notice of final sale to MCRC. The bill also establishes requirements for terminating tenancy of month-to-month and fixed-term tenancies for manufactured dwellings or floating homes, and requires MCRC to produce materials to inform tenants of rights and adopt rules requiring landlords to post the rules. And also requires MCRC to establish and administer a landlord-tenant dispute resolution program, and authorizes MCRC to impose civil penalties against landlords of manufactured dwellings for violation of landlord-tenant law. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a -5 and a -6, which I think you guys will be talking about. We also have a -7 as well.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Julie Fahey, and I represent House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. Last week, Representative Marsh and I came before you to present a series of four bills related to manufactured housing. Mm-hmm. And you should have in front of you, hopefully, a revised version of the handout that we distributed last week and that we walked through. As we discussed last week, in the past, much of the legislation regarding manufactured housing has been put forward by a landlord-tenant coalition specific to manufactured housing. That coalition dissolved last fall. So in the months before session, I had a number of conversations with other legislators about what we think as legislators would be good public policy in this area. We looked at examples in other states. We also looked to AARP has a model statute created by their Public Policy Institute that we looked to. So in the absence of a coalition, Representative Marsh and I proposed the series of bills that we talked about last week. We believe that the changes proposed in these bills are important, given the unique nature of the landlord-tenant relationship in manufactured housing parks. In recent weeks, the coalition has come back together and now strongly believes that legislation related to manufactured housing should be worked through the coalition process. Given that development, we had a meeting last week with one representative from the tenants and one from the owners to talk about the slate of bills. In that meeting, Representative Marsh and I agreed to take two major issues off the table this session because the coalition committed to discuss them this year. Those two items were the enforcement mechanism for landlord-tenant law, which is represented in Bullet 6 under 2008 in the handout, and the right of first refusal for tenants to purchase a park when it goes on the market, which is in House Bill 2990. That also contains the increase in the number of days for tenants to form a committee to purchase the park when it goes on the market. Those are off the table.
I still think that they're good public policy, but they are pretty significant issues, and so I think they'd benefit from working through the coalition process. We also discussed whether there were any minor provisions in 2008 that the owners might agree to not oppose this session, even though they didn't go through the regular coalition process. There were three possibilities identified in 2008, and those were the update of relocation payments found in bullet one, but not the provision about actual reimbursement of real costs, the notification of MCRC when a park is sold, that's in bullet two, and the provisions contained in bullet seven related to cooperatively owned parks. There was no agreement about whether the provisions in bullets 3, 4, and 5 would be on or off the table, nor agreement about 3330 or 3331. Separately, Rep. Marsh and I decided to remove the provisions in bullet 3 and 4 under 2008, as well as House Bill 3330 from consideration. So that sort of walks you through everything that we have removed from off our wish list, which is everything with an X by it on the handout. So we've scaled back 2008 significantly, and we've identified several areas of possible agreement. Still, there's one provision in the data collection section in bullet 5 that was not agreed to by the owners, but that I feel is important because it would allow the legislature to be able to make data-driven policy decisions in the future. We hear a lot of anecdotal evidence in these hearings. You know, last week, Rep. Marsh talked about a constituent of hers that had his space rent tripled in the course of 2 years. But I believe there are many good park owners in Oregon, people who care about their tenants and who are fair and reasonable in their dealings with them. So if we had extra data, you know, for example, on the average high and low space rents by park, as a legislature, we'll be able to more clearly define the range of practice in Oregon and to set policies that address the bad actors while being fair to the good actors. So the Dash 6 amendment before you contains a section about a few pieces of additional data to be collected during the park's regular annual registration process. They already have to submit some data. This would add the name of the park owner and how long they've owned the park, the date of the park's establishment, the number of units moved into or out of the park in the past year, the average high-low space rent in the park, and the utilities included in the rent. Because of this data provision and because of 3331, the owners are no longer supporting the three minor provisions in 2008. So to the amendments on 2008, if you're looking at the Dash 5 and the Dash 6s, the Dash 5 contains only the three minor provisions that the owners that were possible areas of agreement. And the effect of the Dash 6 would be that the bill 2008 would only contain those three things plus the data requirements at park registration. Thank you all for the opportunity to talk through this bill. I know we're deadline week, so I appreciate the opportunity to get into the details on this. And now I'm going to hand it over to the speaker. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Rep, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. On the amendments just described by Representative Fahey, my understanding the Chair will be carrying this over until Tuesday. I hope we can find agreement on the amendment to 2008 that does include the data. I completely agree with my colleague that we all believe manufactured home parks as a source of affordable housing is really important. We as a state have a much more difficult job supporting that sector without a little bit more data. And the goal there is just to have a little bit more data, so hopefully we can reach some compromise and support from the coalition for that amendment by Tuesday. So I just want to put that out there. I think it's important. I have an amendment that is online. It's the Dash 7. I have no expectation you will adopt it, unless you get excited and want to do that. As you heard from Representative Fahey, the discussion of enforcement is going to be put off to have further conversation with the coalition for hopefully next year. The reason I have this amendment, though, is when the coalition negotiated a few years ago the right of opportunity to purchase, that 10-day window where if the owner of a park wants to sell, they have to notify the residents of the park for the opportunity in the very short window to potentially purchase the park. We're not talking about changing the timeline. But what I have in the Dash 7 is just an attempt to say, look, we negotiated something that was very fair, in some ways maybe not as fair as it could have been, but it was negotiated. There was currently in statute that if an owner doesn't abide by the law and let the tenants know that the park is up for sale, there's injunctive relief and some attempted actual damages. The Dash 7 intensifies what the penalty could be. Here's the problem. Back last June in East County in Portland, there's a pretty nice park. And I'm sorry I don't have all the details. I have had trouble getting the article offline. But it was a pretty nice park, not a very large park. But folks who probably, if given enough notification, could have purchased that park. What happened was the owner didn't tell them. In fact, I would say colluded with someone else not to tell them. And then folks had to lose their assets and were evicted from the park. It just was a mess. And there was no significant relief for those residents to say, hey, you didn't give us a chance to potentially purchase that park, even though that's the law. And so this amendment says, if we're going to bring up enforcement next year, if we're not doing it now, we have got to get serious about enforcing that. It's not fair to the folks who those that's their home. They cannot move their homes. They're pretty good homes in a lot of cases. And this owner did not give those residents a chance to make a shot at purchasing that park and then got off scot-free. So that's not okay. So that's why you see the dash 7. Thank you, colleagues.
Any questions? Okay. I want to thank you for working so hard on this. I think that you scaled back your request enormously. I said during the hearing I cared a lot about data. I think your Representative Fahey, your comment about not just acting on anecdotal information is exactly right. How often does that egregious example happen? We may walk away from here thinking that happens all the time, and that may be a really rare case. And we need to make public policy decisions based on data, not based on certain anecdotes or emotion. And so I am hopeful that we can reach agreement on that and that we do it in a way. I know that you've already pared it down from, instead of asking for what the rent is on 70,000 units, you said each park would offer what the lowest, average, and high would be as a way to really simplify it. I understand that with that, there'd be no fiscal on the part of MCHR, that is housed in housing and community services. So it seems like a very reasonable thing to me, and I hope that we can have ongoing discussions and see where we land by Tuesday. So we all have some time to think about it, talk to a variety of people. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I appreciate your efforts toward this, and I think we've always kind of been this way. I know you are, Madam Chair. You'd like to have a coalition, a group working together and everything like that. I find it unfortunate that both Chuck and John, something blew up on this whole thing. They have really worked hard on a number of other issues and really gotten across home plate quite well. I would be really curious their spin on what's going on right now with both these amendments.
Would you like to invite them up?
If they would be willing to.
Okay. Representative Fahey, please stay nearby. Well, actually, why don't we close? Why don't we suspend this and open the next one? Because they might want to comment on both. There's one more bill.
Should we advise them of the Miranda warnings first?
I'm going to suspend House Bill 2008 and open a work session on House Bill 3331 and get a quick summary. Let Representative Fahey talk about that, and then we will invite John and Chuck up for a quick comment.
House Bill 3331 requires the Office of Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations to establish and administer a landlord-tenant dispute resolution program. The bill makes the dispute resolution program available to manufactured dwelling park tenants if the tenant receives a rent increase notice of more than 1% above the specified consumer price index and a majority of tenants agree to dispute the increase. The bill specifies processes for initiation, mediation, and resolution of the dispute resolution program.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Kennegeier. I don't have that much to say. Again, Julie Fahey, State Representative from House District 14. I don't have that much to say about this bill other than the description. It is modeled after a program in the state of Vermont that is not rent stabilization, but mediation if space rent increases are above a certain amount. So it's not binding arbitration. No one would be compelled to come to an agreement or to follow the agreement, but it's just saying we have to get people in a room. When space rent increases are above a certain amount and the tenants object to it, we need to put the people in the room to talk about it. So it's a fairly modest step in terms of trying to think about some of the anecdotes, again, that we have heard about really dramatic rent increases. MCRC already has a mediation program that they run, and so this would be run through that program. Okay, thank you very much.
Would you like to stay, and we'll invite John and Chuck up? Would you guys like to come up for a quick word? And I also want to say, having opened up House Bill 3331, that we will be carrying this over as well until April 18th, 8 a.m.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for the Oregon Law Center in Lane County. And I have been working with two coalitions for since the late 1980s, one for apartment tenancies and one for manufactured home park tenancies. The latter, the manufactured home park tenancy coalition, started in the late 1990s when then-Senator Bill Kenemer said, "We're not going to figure out which of you is right. Go out in the hallway and don't come back until you have a deal." It took us quite a while to get to a deal, but we did in 1997, and we've had that group has negotiated a bill, consensus bill, in every session since 1997. Chuck views them as painful experiences, but, you know, there's sort of a Stockholm syndrome thing going on where we meet for 10 meetings, 3 hours each, and we end up agreeing on something. And we actually have a bill again this session, Senate Bill 277, which passed out of the Senate Human Services Committee yesterday. It'll be coming to you. It passed out unanimously. We had a bit of a struggle there. Representative Olson referred to what happened to that coalition, and I don't know, you know, I live this, Chuck lives it, and we could talk about it for a long time. The short version is that there are two landlord groups and one tenant group, and I'm a board member of the tenant group, and Chuck leads one of the two landlord groups. The other landlord group led an effort to say that that it didn't want to talk about the enforcement issue. You heard Speaker Kotek talk about the enforcement issue a little bit ago. It's an important issue to tenants. Roughly, it is. We pass the tenant layperson view is we pass these good laws through the coalition, but we don't know how. There's no way to enforce them because we can't afford a lawyer, and there are very few lawyers that do this stuff, and so it never gets enforced. So, what does that mean? We don't know exactly, but we wanted to talk about it. One of the landlord groups said, "No, we won't meet with you if you want to talk about that." And that's just not the way coalitions work. I mean, there's no requirement you agree, but there's a sort of a requirement that you talk. And so when that happened last October, the coalition ended. Chuck's group pretty quickly said, "Whoops, that was a mistake. We are willing to talk about that issue. We'll come back together." It took us a while to come back together because breaking up was emotional. So we did start to come back together in January. We met in February. We met again in March. We met again 2 weeks ago, and we reached agreement on 277. And I think that's a good process. And we've committed. We've already set a meeting for May. We'll start with May, getting ready for 2018, working on things like enforcement and opportunity to purchase, the other issue that Speaker Kotek talked about a few minutes ago. So that's the background of the coalition. And I think what it reflects is a commitment by the two of us that, yes, we may not get what we want as much as we want, as quickly as we want, but this is a long-term process. It's worked well for 20 years, and we want to preserve it. And preserving it means that the two of us are in union when issues come up that we aren't in agreement on. So we greatly respect and appreciate Representative Fahey and Representative Marsh's interest in parks. There are a lot of great ideas in 2008, but there are a couple of ideas in 2008 that we don't agree with. And so we can't support 2008 as amended with it's Section 3, I believe, the extra data. And we thought
Dash
that
six.
In the Dash 6, excuse me, in the Dash 6, not in the Dash 5. We would support the Dash 5, I think Chuck will say for himself, but we also, as part of that, understood that 3331 would not move forward, and we misunderstood that. So we understand that Representative Fahey does want 3331 to move forward. It's a form, she described it a second ago. I don't read it quite the same way, but it's something that the landlords don't agree to. So that's where we are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I want to thank John Van Landenham for all his work over the 20 years that I've been involved with the coalition. There would be no coalition.
Your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and we represent about 541 communities in the state of Oregon, and we sponsor landlord-tenant training sessions throughout the year. So as I was saying earlier, I want to thank John for all his hard work over the past 20 years. Don't always see eye to eye, but he always negotiates fairly and I think from the right place. And I think over the last 20 years, we've been able to produce some pretty good products. I listed those products last week when we testified before this committee. I think one of the, and I also want to thank Representative Fahey for her time over the last 2 weeks. We've gotten to know each other fairly well over the phone after some lengthy conversations. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for always being accessible, not only during session, but during the off session, and trying to work with us to find common ground. So thank you, everybody. I think where we are is our concern is that at some point the coalition doesn't mean anything if when you're negotiating, the other side knows, and I'm not saying this is what happened. This is definitely not what happened in this case. But if the other side goes to the legislature, when they don't get what they want in coalition, then they have another way of getting around it. And I think that in the end probably is not good for the long-term health of the coalition. We are happy to talk about the issues I mentioned to you as far as data. We are collecting data, and I'm happy to share that data with you. I'm happy to share it with all of you. Last week gave you 8 pages of what rent is over the last 5 years. But I think fundamentally we have a problem with the state collecting that information. And to be honest with you, I think our concern is, and some of this is based on my experience of giving you the data that we provided last week. We've been providing that data to folks as we've met with you over the last year. When the data is good and there's no problem, you say to me, well, this means we can do rent control because there's no problem here, and obviously you can conform to rent control because rents aren't going up as fast as they were. And then obviously if there's outliers there and there's problems, then obviously the issue is going to be you need to have rent control. So we can't win for losing. I mean, we provide this information to you, and you're going to use it to justify whatever means you want to justify. So we find that very frustrating. We find it difficult to be working with MCRC, which is probably another issue, but there is a tremendous lack of trust between, or at least from the landlord side, towards that agency. And I think, finally, when you look at Section 3 and the dash 6, other information required by the department can be collected. So does that mean you can go in and find out what our profit and loss statements are, how much money we're making, how much money we're losing? I think it raises a lot of concerns on our part. We feel that we have, in good faith, come to you outside of the coalition. Because remember, we have Senate Bill 277, which deals with disrepair and deterioration, which was a big issue this past summer with Cal-Am. We're happy to support that bill. We're thrilled that there's a coalition bill. I think we turned out another good piece of legislation with that. And we were happy to work with Representative Marsh, Representative Fahey, and with John Van Landenham to come up with some other issues that we can throw on the table. The park closure piece is significant, and we talked about park closure back in, I think, 2005 for a year and a half, 3 hours every month. And what we did in 10 minutes really would have taken us in coalition much longer period of time. We're happy to do that. It should have been done in 2005. We're happy to make that change. As far as some of the things with co-ops, I think we think that's a positive thing for both residents and landlords. I would say community owners and homeowners. And then the final piece of this agreement where on the park sale piece where information is provided back to the residents, back to the homeowners, we think is fair, and I think I have board members who believe that that is probably an important piece of information. But we can't go any further.
Yes, question.
Thank you, Chair Kenegar. Chuck, I just want to clarify. When you say you give us, or you use the word you, you said when we give you information, you kind of use it for whatever you want. Are you talking about just the legislative body in general? When you say You use it for whatever
I think
you
we're
want.
All guilty of that, Representative.
Okay, I'm just clarifying that you weren't trying to pick out anyone specific in that statement.
I think fundamentally, Madam Chair, Representative, I think fundamentally there is angst on the part of community owners that the state is reaching in and requiring information. And I think they feel very uncomfortable about that. They feel very uncomfortable about a statement that any other information required by the department is pretty broad. Well, I'm happy to, as I committed to you last night, Madam Chair, I'm happy to talk about this in coalition and try to find some common ground on this and come back and see what we can do. I make that commitment to Representative Fahey and all of you that we will negotiate in good faith. We'll talk about these issues and we'll see where we can find common ground.
So I appreciate that. I appreciate the data you've given. I know it's, I believe that the data you've given is for the ones that you represent. Mm-hmm. So it's an incomplete picture. Mm-hmm. I think that you have a great association. And so some of the bad actors that may be out there may not be the ones that you're representing. And that is part of the point of the data, again, to have a complete picture. I just want to say, as the chair of this committee, philosophically, that I really appreciate the coalition. And when you bring bills forward as the coalition, and we know that all stakeholder opinions have been worked out, it's a green light. But if that were the only path, that gives no opportunity for agreements that where you haven't come to an agreement. And I don't feel that I would be a good chair of this committee or a good representative of the people of the state of Oregon if I said that was the only thing we were going to do. I think there has to be an alternative path. It's clearly a harder path. It's a yellow light, maybe green or red in the end. It's obviously a harder path, but I believe that that path has to be there for discussions where you haven't come into consensus. And that is the reason that we will continue to entertain issues, have them on the table, and see how far we're going to. We don't have the paperwork anyway, but I also think that, you know, I hope that the discussions have been productive. They've been bumpy at times, and I think that some of the clarifications that needed to happen out of miscommunication are happening. And wherever we get on Tuesday, I really appreciate your willingness to put whatever issues we do not deal with in this session on the table. So thank you very much for taking all this very seriously, also being approachable when I call you really late at night to talk about these issues. So thank you, everyone, for this. Thank you, Representative Fahey, for bringing these very important issues forward. Okay, I'm going to close
thank
the
you.
Work sessions on both House Bill 2008 and the work session on House Bill 3331 and open a House Bill work session on House Bill 2852. Representative Leininger, thank you for being very patient. And Cassie, could you please read a brief?
Did we just roll over 3331?
We did. I said it in the beginning.
Oh, okay.
We're going to go through yep. all of the ones thanks. We're carrying. Just, over.
Thank you. Yeah. We want to make sure we don't forget anything. Thank you, Rose Leininger. We will have, can you read a brief summary?
Yep. House Bill 2852 extends the sunset date for affordable housing lenders tax credit to January 1st, 2026, and increases the total amount of tax credits allowed for all taxpayers per the fiscal year to $34 million. It is effective 91 days following sine die. We have a -2 amendment, and the -2 amendment requires Housing and Community Services Department to determine the remaining balance of the reserved tax credits for tax years beginning in the calendar year, and requires Department of Revenue in collaboration with OHCS to conduct an auction of the reserved tax credits no later than December 1st of the tax year for which the credits are allowed, and specifies tax credit auction requirements. The amendment requires Department of Revenue to deposit net receipts in the general housing account to provide housing for low-income individuals and families with a priority to manufactured dwellings and manufactured dwelling parks. The amendment requires manufactured dwellings to be that are preserved or replaced by the tax credit auction proceeds to be owned by specific entities, and allows the credit purchased at the auction to be allowed against taxes due. The amendment decreases the total amount of tax credits allowed for all taxpayers per fiscal year to $25 million. And we do have a -3, and the -3 just includes manufactured dwelling parks within the requirement that manufactured dwellings and manufactured dwelling parks be preserved or replaced by the tax credit auction proceeds to be owned by specific entities.
And before you start, I know we've had a work group with two members of our own committee, Representative Noble, Representative Meek. Would you guys like to join?
I would like to join. I have some.
Would you like to come?
Sure, thank you,
Representative Noble. Would you like to join her?
I think Representative Meek will probably
represent
voice
your work group.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger from House District 38. And I want to start by thanking Representative Noble and Representative Meek for the tremendous work that they did together with Allison McIntosh and Chris Allenack, Bill Van Vliet, and possibly others to reach some accommodations on the bill that help meet needs more effectively and hopefully can help us move this smoothly forward and do some really important work for Oregonians in terms of access to affordable housing. This is another tool on the supply side of addressing the affordable housing crisis that we face. Just quickly to refresh, since 1989, the OAHTC has helped build 16,800 affordable units, over 40% of which are in rural areas. It's an efficient tool. It's replenished upon the repayment. And so it's been offering quite close to the ceiling of the available funding. And by having an increase to the $25 million amount that Representatives Noble and Meek identified, we could help invigorate construction activity, development of additional affordable units. And I want to note that it would leverage an additional $200 million in private debt to support projects if we were to do that $25 million suggestion in the amendments. Mainly want to thank your leadership and the work group for helping evolve this concept to something that I think will make it even more meaningful. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Meek. And I believe that Bill Van Vliet is also available to answer any technical questions regarding the amendments.
Thank you, Representative Leininger. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Meek, representative for House District 40, and I thank you for consideration of this amendment today for House Bill 2852. And I also thank the good work that Representative Noble did with this. And we spent really tight window frames of just dedicating time to this resource and our work partners also. But we convened this group of experts for the affordable housing, Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. And we want to make the recommendations to enhance it. The work group included experts from Legislative Revenue Office, Oregon Housing Community Services, Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, and the Oregon Housing Alliance. And we began meeting March 6th and met for four times over the course of this month. And upon Chair Kenny Geyer's request, the conversations that we are doing now, we wanted to find out what's working now, what's not working, what can we do to improve this. And we came up with, I think, with some really good additions. So we wanted to figure out, you know, the tax credit and its mechanism and discuss the potential changes for it. We also reviewed the work of an earlier work group convened by the Oregon Housing and Community Services, which considered proposals to make the OAHTC more efficient. The work group had discussions regarding how this tax credit fits with other tools and strategies used by the OHCS to finance affordable housing and to increase the supply of affordable housing. So the recommendations include extending the sunset on the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit to 2026, which is 6 years further than the current sunset of 2020, and expanding the affordable housing tax credit from its current cap of $17 million to $25 million. The work group did consider expanding the credit to the $34 million proposed in House Bill 2852, but instead decided to recommend the cap should be extended to $25 million in 2017 with the direction that the Oregon Housing and Community Services, that they fully expend those funds needed to build more affordable housing and then return to the legislature when they've reached that cap of $25 million. And if it takes several years to do that, hopefully we're very efficient and economical in using those funds. It is also the hope of this member of the members of this work group that this will happen sooner than later, and because there is definitely a great need for affordable housing across Oregon. And lastly, the work group considered several proposals for alternatives, and And one of his recommendations changed to how the tax credit that's sitting there that's been proposed is kind of dormant for a year or two while they're waiting to provide all their resources. So the development timeline for affordable housing projects is long. It includes the developer being awarded and then assembling the financing, local permitting processes, and then the construction. So from the date that the OHTC is awarded or reserved, the credit is considered by OHCS to be spent with regards to the cap, even though no taxpayer is claiming the credit during this period. So what we're proposing is to design a simple system to convert those reserved tax credits under the existing cap to cash each year. So each calendar year, the reserved credits for that year could be sold at a tax credit auction to taxpayers to generate cash for housing. This would simply make use of a committed but unused resource each year. So this is that one-year tax credit, and that that could be used to increase funding for affordable housing. So it's using maximizing the use of this credit when it's basically sitting there dormant and may not be used for a year or two down the road. So there are a number of experts here today that can help answer a lot of your other technical questions. But after spending 4 weeks on this with Representative Noble and the work group partners and digging into the tax credits, we believe that we bring into the committee three solid recommendations in the form of this amendments. And we urge your yes vote and support on this. Thank you, Chair.
Bill, would you like to come up and join just in case there are any questions? You can maybe make a quick comment. You were part of the work group, one of the primary nonprofits doing affordable housing lending in the state.
Thank
if
you.
Not the primary. Or maybe the only.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. My name is Bill Van Vliet. I'm the executive director with NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, and we're a statewide nonprofit that finances affordable housing projects through a number of different programs. And I appreciate the work of the work group. I appreciate Representative Langer putting this bill forward. We covered some great ground. Representative Meek did a great job. I think he's a certified expert now in describing what this proposal is going to do. And so with that, I'll just take any questions. I don't know that there's more to expand.
And would you like to say anything?
I would love to. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I was very wise in not having to sit down there and compete, because I think Representative Meek and Mr. Van Vliet actually represented the work group very well. A lot of discussion and understanding tax credits and how this works in this particular one. So I also would urge the amendment to be passed.
Great. And we have Chris Allen from Legislative Revenue Office in the back if there are any questions. Any questions about how this would work? Again, I want to say there are really only two dedicated sources of funding for affordable housing. One is the DOC fee and the other is this. And we, when we saw graphs in the beginning of the money that was out there being lent for new affordable housing, we were right up at very close to that $17 million cap, which was the reason the governor had a bill that was just simply extending, because we have to go through a review every 6 years of all tax credits. Her bill was just simply to extend it as is, and Representative Leininger brought a bill that would double that cap from 17 to $34 million. You may have heard me say early on, why are we stopping at 34 when we need so much? Why aren't we going to 50? The committee decided to go the other way, which I personally regret, to tell you the truth. But I do think that you have made this tax credit so much more usable in so many ways, more effective, more efficient, that it may actually be out there supporting as many projects as I hoped would be by increasing the cap. And I do appreciate you putting on record that at the point that we hit that next cap, that we should reconsider whether it's doing the job that we want it to do and possibly go further. So I appreciate that being on the record. Any questions for our panel? Okay, and if not, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
thank
this
you.
Really very serious, very, very important bill. And I think that the amendments are not available. Is that correct? Are they online?
Yeah.
They are online.
Yeah.
And we are going to be looking at adopting the dash 2 and the dash 3.
Just the dash three.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The dash three is identical to the dash two, except it includes manufactured dwelling.
Okay,
cars.
Great. And we've got that. And the fiscal is requested but not available. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so we can adopt in this work session the amendment, and we will, for the record, carry over this bill till Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m. at which time we will have the fiscal. So a motion for Sanchez, Vice Chair Sanchez.
Dash three. The dash three. Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated April 12,
2017. Okay, yeah, that's right. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Okay, Representative Sanchez moves, Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the dash three amendments dated April 12, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any objection? All right. The amendments are adopted, and I close the work session on House Bill 2852. Thank you very much. I'm going to go back to a few that we missed because I want to make sure that we don't – I skipped over because we had some representatives in the room. But we're going to go back to work session on House Bill 2996, Representative Meeks, first-time home buyer savings account. Jesse, can you read us a summary?
House Bill 2996 allows an individual to create a first-time home buyer savings account at a financial institution to pay or reimburse costs for purchase of a single-family residence. The bill requires an account holder to submit transaction information from the savings account to Department of Revenue on prepared forms during the tax year and allows the account holder to claim subtraction and exemption for the aggregate total of the principal and earnings not exceeding $50,000. The bill specifies withdrawal of the fund to be for purchases other than the purchase of a single family residence must be included in the account holder's taxable income and requires Department of Revenue to prepare forms and informational materials on the first-time home buyer savings account. This applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018 and before January 1st, 2024 and is effective the 91st day following signee die.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Meek from House District 40 again, and Chair Kennegar, and I just sat before this committee a month ago to introduce House Bill 2996, and as you all may remember, the bill creates a tool that is a key for prospective first-time home buyers to be able to save towards the down payment of their first home. And today I bring you a few changes that will tailor the bill to provide meaningful help to hardworking Oregonians who are still struggling to save for their first-time home. It is becoming increasingly difficult for working families to pull together the extra dollars it takes to buy their first home. Rising student debt and higher rents are becoming major obstacles and roadblocks to achieving what we call the American dream. And so these changes will make sure that we are helping those who need it while avoiding the unintended consequences of giving tax credit to those who don't need it. So we're looking to amend House Bill 2996 with a means test that will cap the eligibility based on adjusted gross income, AGI, for a single filer at $100,000 with a phase out up to earnings of $125,000 per year, and then or filing jointly at the $200,000 mark, phasing out at $250,000. So it means testing for that. And then we also considered allowing the recipient the chance to deduct their student debt. My concern was if we means test this, we have a lot of hardworking folks that spend years in college getting their doctorates, getting their lawyer's degrees, and they may come out and have a chance to really, with their skill level, maybe earn $250,000. But they're going to have a lot of expenses trying to pay for their education. So I didn't want to. I know those hardworking professionals need the chance to buy their first home also. So we put in a segment to allow for subtraction of the annual student loan debt load from their AGI.
And then, and I kind of gave you an example, I'll give you an example. Student loan debt payment annually is $12,000. Well, they allow the account beneficiary to subtract $12,000 from their AGI to determine their eligibility. And then also the eligibility to make sure it's specifically for the recipient and the person buying this first-time home. So the eligibility is for only the first-time home buyer for the tax credit subtraction, not the person that opens the tax account for somebody else, a beneficiary of that. So we're just making sure we clean it up, that this is not a tax haven, but it is a great tool to help first-time home buyers to a hand up, helping them to put money aside to, you know, hopefully qualify to buy their first home in the near future. So thank you very much, Chair Kindergarten, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
The amendment is not ready, so we're going to be holding this over. The purpose of having all these conversations today is that because of the paperwork being behind, we know we have a lot of bills on Tuesday, and this, by raising issues, if there's any clarification you want between now and Tuesday, you have the opportunity to do that. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is a great thing, and I commend the work that's being done in just the concept. I appreciate proceeding cautiously. If I had my magic wand, I would make it really similar to a 529 savings plan. As we've talked a lot in this committee about security and housing and how that impacts everything else, including education. Mm-hmm. I know it may take a few years to get there, but being able to provide housing at the similar level that we provide education savings, I think is where I would see it go. But I appreciate all the work and the proceeding cautiously with the amendments.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. In case I failed to say it before, we are carrying this over to Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m., and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2996. Thank you, Representative Meek. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2661 for the purpose of adopting an amendment. We are not ready on the paperwork, so I'm going to carry over the bill to Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m., but we have two amendments to be considered. Why don't you just describe the amendment let's have a motion, because Representative Meek would like to move the dash 7 is the rescind, right?
Dash 7.
Make sure I've got the right one.
Yeah, you're right.
Dash 7 is rescind. The rescind.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
So we are going to dash 7 is the rescind. We're gonna hear two amendments. Yes, why don't you? Do you have the paperwork on that?
So, yeah. Dash 8 is one and done.
Right.
Dash 7 is
right.
Done.
Yeah.
I,
so we're going to.
I got them.
So we've got two amendments that are going to be proposed.
I'd rather Meek move the 8s.
Pardon me?
We're doing just fine.
I would just like to speak to dash 7. Then.
Yes. That's fine. You can move it for the record. It's not written up, so you need a little prompting, but go ahead and start, and we'll fill in the dates and things for you.
Madam Chair, I move a dash 7, but is that right?
Yes,
am
that's
I
right.
Correct? To be amended to the House Bill 2661 with the due pass recommendation.
And it's a dated.
We're just doing the amendments.
Right. The amendment is dated.
Dated 4-12-17.
4-12-17. Thank you. So Representative Meek moves the dash 7 dated 4-12-17 to House Bill 2661. And open it up for discussion.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. I just want to speak in favor of this. And I just really, truly want to speak in favor of all the good work that all the partners did. There's work groups. And I think the bill, House Bill 20...
Explain the amendment.
The amendment, what that would do is there was several contentious issues, and one of the issues that I wanted to have opportunity for the consumer is that they would have the opportunity, if they came to the website, they came to either a person that they were on the boots on the ground or somebody else, and it just wasn't working. So maybe they want to go from a boots on the ground to another boots on the ground, and they have the opportunity to rescind, or they want to go from one website, national website, to another, maybe local website, whatever it is, that they have the opportunity to freely move between one provider to the next. And it's not so much that they actually have to pay for these services, but they are limited on who will be willing to serve them if they are locked in with another company for the purposes of this long-term referral process. So my hope was that the consumer and or somebody that was, you know, looking for better services and opportunity to change freely within a market would have that opportunity. So I was looking for this rescission process where it's just a simple, you know, thank you for your services. I appreciate everything you've done for me, but it's just not working, and I'd like the opportunity to work with somebody else. And that is all it is offering. The good work that the partners worked on is fantastic. I love all the disclosures, making this a little more professionally run program. But minus this rescission process, I think you really you kind of lose your opportunity to freely move within the market of different services that are offered. And that's why I was hoping that we could consider this -7 amendment for the rescission.
So, Madam Chair,
yes.
I just want to share some bullet points on the -7s, okay, and some talking points that I have here. The right of rescission language in -7 amendments would allow a third party who is not a party to contract to unilaterally alter the contract. And this runs afoul with contract law and is unlikely to stand up in court, is what, you know, I feel. Moreover, this also could put the parties to the contract at risk of being sued for breach of contract. The second point is, most importantly, the -7s would place the families in the middle of a dispute between referral agencies and have to determine who gets paid and who doesn't. And then finally, the proponents of the -7s have offered no data to support that this is actually a problem.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson. I'll speak up in favor of it. I think that I've really been convinced by Representative Meek, who didn't choose to mention, but I'll mention, that he comes out of the real estate business. And so when a realtor has been showing someone around and may have invested time and resources, and then 2 months later that may not be working out, the consumer has the right to switch. And so once I kind of saw it in those terms, I thought in terms of consumer protection, really ultimately why wouldn't we be doing that? And I did see this as a possible advantage for the small businesses in our state to have more of a crack at that. So philosophically, I'm aligned, but I'm actually very, very happy with both amendments. So I'm not big stake in the ground on this one, but I do just want to speak to that.
Well, just okay. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think the -8s, which we haven't heard, right. I would, you know, get to what you're interested in.
Yes, so. I agree.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The thing that's concerning about the -7 is that the business model for the national companies is set up in such a way that they make their money on the front end. And so this would undercut that, and I think it's an unfair interference into the normal operations of business, so I'm opposed to it.
Okay. Any other comments? Yes.
And Madam Chair, I'm along those lines as well, and I actually think that if we undercut that business model on the national level, that we actually reduce the number of people doing this, and therefore make it harder on people, because, in my opinion, it'll reduce the number of referral agencies that we actually have.
Okay. Well, Clerk, can you please call the roll?
Representative Gorsuch?
No.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Newman?
No.
Representative Noble?
No.
Representative Peluso?
No.
Representative Stark?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Degar?
Aye. Okay, the motion fails, and I think we have a motion on the -8.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the -8 amendments dated 4/12/17.
Okay, Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the -8 amendments dated 4/12/17. Is there any discussion on that? So, who would like to introduce the concept of that?
Well,
we're affectionately known as the one and done.
I'm not going to introduce.
Would you, Cassie? Would you
go
like
ahead
to read the summary on
-8,
or I will attempt to do it?
-8 requires a referral agent to provide a client with disclosure regarding description of referral. Referrals agent referral agents' contact information, private policy statement, provision of referrals to facilities contracted with the agent, and a statement of whether the referral fees will be paid to the agent by the facility. The dash 8 prohibits an agent from sharing a client's placement information, selling client's placement information, referring a client to a facility with an ownership interest, and contacting a client after written notice to stop contact. The dash 8 prohibits compensations from a facility in connection with the client after a written notice from the client to terminate the relationship with the agent, and specifies an agent may not accept the compensation from another facility in connection with the client upon receipt of written notice that the client wishes to use a different agent. The dash 8 requires an agent to prohibit and contract with the facility the collection of compensation from a facility if a new referral agent refers the same client to the same facility under specific circumstances, and is applicable to contracts entered into or after July 1st, 2018. The dash 8 requires persons providing long-term care referrals to register with Department of Human Services, and requires referral agents to be mandatory reporters of elder abuse. This becomes operative July 1st, 2018, and the amendment declares an emergency effective on passage.
So that was a summary of the entire gut and stuff. Both of them were gut and stuffs, with the only difference between the 7 and the 8 having to do with this either right to rescind or in the dash 8, what we're calling the one and done. And so basically what that means is if you have, for instance, an internet company that has a two-year contract, once they have your name and they're giving you a referral to a number of facilities, they have a two-year contract with those facilities, and they will be compensated by that one of those facilities if the client ends up going to one of those facilities. What this says is, after the first referral where someone has already been placed at a facility, then at that point, if the person wants to move, either they're not happy at the facility or they need a increased standard of care and so they need a different kind of facility, then at that point they can request, they can opt out of the agreement that they have with the company that referred them. So the company will get compensated. Their costs will be covered, more than covered, by the compensation they've already received at the first facility, but it's not an opt-in where they have to choose to go with the company. It's just an opt-out where at that point they can say, all right, now I want to be served by somebody else. I'm either not happy with this facility or I need a different standard of care. So we're calling it the one and done. Are any questions on that proposal? Okay.
Madam Chair, I just want to speak to this bill, and I will support this. But I want to just, Madam Chair, I just hope my family has dealt with this, and I just hope that, Madam Chair, you never have to personally experience the agony of having to, try to place your loved one that is losing their facilities and capacity just to make decisions for themselves, and that you have to go through this process. And one and done, it's difficult moving your parent around and moving your loved one around. And so that's why I wanted to support the opportunity for to protect our consumers. But, one and done, if you're able to go out and find somebody else that maybe do a better job for you the next time if you made a mistake, that's why I'm glad that this is being part of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Vice Chair Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to say that the reason I'm fine with this at this point in time. We go with it. It's not the end of the world. But the reason I really was hoping for the right to rescind is because from a trauma-informed perspective, when people are dealing with this issue first time it happens, I think I explained to some folks, I had to move my mom from her own living situation because she had like lost 30 pounds immediately within a few weeks, and her dementia was moving very, very quickly, and that was that realization that she had stopped cooking for herself because she couldn't understand what was going on in her life, and so I had to do that really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine from trauma, mm-hmm, how people deal with that kind of trauma when that's happening, or even worse situations. I think my mother's situation was fairly easy, mm-hmm, relatively speaking. But whether or not you get the opportunity to remember the things that they're telling you, you know, over the phone. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. And even, are you going to be able to remember that you have an opportunity to do a written rescission of your decision even after the first time? Mm-hmm. Those are just hard things, and I just think that the opportunity to have that, the ability to say, yeah, this isn't working for me over the phone, I need somebody to show me. You know, there are people who just learn or think differently about it, and, you know, if this is what we can do right now, then fine. But, again, an opportunity for people to really, you know, again, from a trauma-informed perspective, this is not the easy way to do it.
So I appreciate that, and I just want to give my strong support for the Dash 8 as well. I think that this moves us forward in a little bit more consumer choice, and it you know, definitely places an emphasis on making sure that business models are compensated for the work they've done, with the eye toward making sure we have as many business models out there to meet the needs of people. I think that's what I heard from people who said why they were leaning toward 8. I think both of them were really big steps forward, and I look forward to discussion between now and Tuesday on the underlying bill and all of the different ways in which this entire bill really improves the quality of the standard of care in this whole sector. So I'm excited to vote on this amendment. Any further discussion on it? Is there any objection to the dash 8? Okay, seeing none, the dash 8 is adopted, and I'm going to close the work session on, well, I want to make sure I said we're carrying this over to Tuesday, April 18th, when we will have the fiscals back, 8 a.m., and I'm going to close the work session on 2661. Open a work session on House Bill 2930. It's Representative Boone's required notification to military regarding child abuse. I'm not going to have you read the summary because we're starting to run out of time.
Do you want me to read the amendment?
Just the amendment, yep.
Great.
Which I think is short, right?
Mm-hmm. The Dash 1 amendment for House Bill 2930 removes requirements for DHS and law enforcement agency to determine military status and notification to the Oregon Military Department and the U.S. Department of Defense, and allows DHS or the law enforcement agency to collect information regarding military status of a parent or guardian of a child who is the subject of a child abuse report, and allows DHS or the law enforcement agency to share that information concerning military status with the appropriate military authorities.
Okay, can I have a motion?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 12, 2017.
Okay, Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 4/12/2017. Any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Boone and I talked about this just the other day, and she's worked with the chiefs and the sheriffs on this issue, as well as with the DA's Association, and that's where you get the Dash 1s right now.
And everyone seems to be in agreement with that, is what I've heard.
I need a little further explanation. Could we just run through that one more time?
Through the Dash 1?
Yeah.
Well, essentially what it does is it makes it permissive. That's it.
It allows it as opposed to requiring it.
Got it. All righty. That helps.
That's all it is. It's just permissive.
Thank you.
And it's trying to give information to the military about child mm-hmm. abuse so that they can design
Got
programs
it.
If needed. Mm-hmm. I think.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So
are we moving?
Any other discussion on the amendments? Any objection to the amendments? Amendments are adopted. Motion on the bill.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2930 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2930 as recommended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Borsig?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nearman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative
Bruce?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye. Aye. The motion passes. We'll assign Representative Boone to be the carrier. And how about we have Representative Olson to be the backup if for any reason she's not there?
I'll roger that.
Okay. I'm going to open, so I'm closing the House Bill, a work session on House Bill 2930, opening House work session on House Bill 3370.
Ten four.
Is there a short amendment summary you can give us? If not, I will have Representative Sanchez.
I can summarize it. So we have a dash one amendment for House Bill 3370, and it defines housing with services project and outlines the types of health and social services included within the housing with services project, and requires the housing with services project to register with DHS, and also specifies that DHS collaborate with OHCS and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
I'm just realizing this is a carryover because we don't have the paperwork.
Yeah. Right.
I was going to say.
Okay. Sorry about that. I'm going to carry this over to Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m. and close the work session on House Bill 3370, open a work session on House Bill 3155 for the purpose of carrying it over to April 18th, 8 a.m. Still waiting on amendments. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3155, and I want to reiterate, in case I missed anything, the following bills are going to be carried over to Tuesday, April 18th at 8 a.m. House Bill 2996, 2661, 2007, 2008, 3331, 2852, 3370, 3155. With that, we are adjourned.
Very good.
2 minutes to 10.
Very good.
2 minutes to 10. We are adjourned.